supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll be talking about celosia, otherwise known as coxcomb. You may think you know which kind of plant we're talking about, but you might not. There's two very different types, and we will discuss them towards the end of the show. We're also going to talk to pest control expert Ed Rosenthal. And that's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Hannah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Hannah. How are you?
Okay, I'm fine. And how are you?
I am doing very well today. Thank you for asking. Where is Hannah Fine?
I am in State College, Pennsylvania.
Okay, but you don't sound like a native Pennsylvanian, Hannah.
Believe it or not, I have lived here for 50 years and gardened here, but I am still having the accent.
Yes, well, it's a charming accent. There's no reason to...
Oh, thank you very much.
And is it German?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And I have a question for you, Mike. I have a lot of what looks like clover. Now, in general, I don't mind clover, and I have it in some spots in my lawn. But this kind of clover, which I have all over my perennial beds and in the cracks of my stone walk, it has smaller leaves than the white blooming clover. Once this starts getting blossoms, there are like little tiny yellow blossoms. And when I pull it out, which I have been doing since May, constantly. Now, what I have been using between the stones, I have used vinegar in a spray bottle, and of course that helped. And I also have used boiling water. But I'm shying away of doing the same thing with my flower beds.
In your lawn, you have the traditional white clover.
Yes, on some spots, and I don't mind it. It looks kind of pleasant to me. Now, maybe my neighbors might have a different opinion, but I don't mind it. It kind of looks cheerful.
Up until the mid-1960s, clover was actually included in all lawn seed mixes because clover takes nitrogen from the air and stores it inside its biomass. So when you cut a lawn that has clover on it, the resulting clippings are very rich in nitrogen, which is the primary plant food. It was a way of making lawns sustainable that I guess lawn food companies didn't like the idea of. So they started telling people to feed their lawns artificially and got the clover out of the lawn seed mixture.
This, what I'm talking about, it has long roots. They are more on the surface, and the leaves are smaller, tinier. And as I said, once it gets blossoms, it has like little tiny yellow blossoms. And I use compost for my flower beds, and I have quite an operation of compost bins. So I don't know what happened this year.
Well, is this plant that's invading your perennial garden, is it more of a vine?
No, it looks, it's like a compact plant.
And it's yellow.
The leaves are green. But the little tiny blossoms, which eventually come up if I'm not getting to it before that, very tiny yellow blossoms.
Because that makes me think of wild strawberry, but clearly that's a...
No, it is not.
That's a vining plant. And it's not buttercup. You know what buttercup looks like.
Yes, right.
Here's your big options. you know, one, you want to, you know, try to make a knockdown, try to really soak the soil, pull out as many as you can.
Right.
And then vinegar is a very good option, especially with a good spray bottle. What you need is a partner so that when you spray the vinegar onto the plant, the partner can simply be holding a big piece of cardboard.
Yes.
So that you don't hit the other plants that are behind
right.
it. That's that's an old technique in using herbicides. You're just using regular 5% vinegar, right? Pickling vinegar, white vinegar?
Yes.
If you look around, you should be able to find vinegars that are somewhat higher strength, horticultural vinegars. Some really hip gardening centers will have vinegars that are 8 or 10%. There are herbicidal soaps. There are soap sprays that you can use that coat the weed and smother it. But we are leaving the season where herbicides work. Herbicides are at their best on hot, dry, sunny days. So this is the time to be pulling, planning, getting your supplies together, and getting ready for next season. But if you have a high-strength vinegar, and if you use a high-strength vinegar, make sure you wear protective glasses just to make sure in case the wind should change.
All right.
And get an herbicidal soap. And there's also a new type of herbicide that uses iron as the active ingredient. And Gardens Alive sells that as Iron X, but I think it's also available under other names. So you've got herbicidal soap, you've got iron, and you've got high-strength vinegar. Just remember, this time of year, pulling is the most effective. And then next summer, when we get into the long, hot, sunny days, that's when you can really toast these plants. You could also consider getting a flame weeder, a propane-powered flame weeder.
All right. Okay. Well, I hope it will work.
All right. Good luck, Hannah.
Yes, thank you very much, and have a good day.
You
and
too.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
You're
bye-bye.
Welcome. Goodbye.
1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I'm calling from Califon, New Jersey. We're 20 miles north of Flemington in Hunterdon County.
Okay, very good.
I'm calling about the answer you gave last week to the person who had purchased an old apple orchard up in New England.
Oh, and I had to give them the devastating gut punch news that old apple orchards tend to be heavily contaminated with arsenate of lead, the old really toxic pesticide that was used on all kinds of orchards back in the day.
Yes, back in the day, meaning 1890s up through the 1960s, and it was banned then in the 80s. I was so glad you gave that answer, because that's not something people are aware of. I've been a member of the New Jersey Mycological Association for about 15 years now, and one of our members became really sick from lead arsenate poisoning. He had been collecting morel mushrooms, which grow symbiotically with old apple trees, but the problem is if you go to old orchards, the soil's been contaminated with lead arsenate. He did not realize that for years. And had been eating the correct mushroom. He wasn't poisoned because he was eating the wrong mushroom. He was eating a very choice mushroom. But then his doctor, and on another note, decided his cholesterol was too high and he needed to lose some weight. And rather than go on drugs, this gentleman decided he'd lose the weight. Well, as he lost weight, he began to feel even more terrible. The lead arsenate had been contained in the fat in his body, and because the fat was gone, then the lead arsenate was released, and it was affecting his back, and it affected his eyesight. He's been recovering slowly, still having problems, but he's much better than he was. So this is something everybody needs to watch out for. That's why I cringe when people talk about eating wild collected mushrooms. The only time I eat morels is when I've collected them myself from my apple trees that were planted in the late 50s by my father-in-law, and they were never sprayed because they weren't interested in anything like that.
I can't tell you how bad I felt about that phone call. And it was like the old Oscar Wilde line. The only way I would have felt worse is if I hadn't told the guy that he bought a real toxic waste problem. But, you know, I never made that comparison, even though it's an obvious connection. Morel mushrooms are some of the easiest to identify. They're the most prized by mushroom hunters. They come up in the spring. And as you say, there's this curious symbiotic relationship with fruit trees and morel mushrooms.
Yeah, specifically apple trees and morels. And I guess it's 80%, I just heard someone get the statistic, 80% of the plants on Earth need a fungal relationship to do really well, so using them as mycorrhizae. So that's important to keep in mind, that mushrooms are our friends in many ways. So we need to keep an eye out for them as well.
I know my friend Paul Stamets at Fungi Perfecti has told me one of the great uses of mushrooms is to remediate heavy metals and toxins from soil. But then the mushrooms have to be burned and destroyed.
Right.
Well, Carol, thank you for that added warning. This is just a sad story that gets sadder, but hopefully all these things build up and one by one we convince people not to just do these terrible things anymore.
I hope not.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Carol. That's an excellent warning.
You're welcome, Mike. Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll give a free talk on turning your fall leaves into garden gold for the Lower Merion Conservancy at St. Joseph's University on Wednesday evening, October 23rd. And then I'll lead a trip to Cuba, that's right, Cuba, to explore their botanical wonders this coming January 14th to the 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with pest control tips, a tale of two coxcombs, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that late summer and early fall are the time to plant garlic and spring bulbs and cool weather crops like salad greens and pansies. More information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, you may think you know what kind of plant a coxcomb is, but we're going to test whether you do or not when we get to the question of the week and talk about the two very different types of plants that are known by that common name. We're also going to take lots more of your fascinating phone calls, but now it is time to welcome our special guest, pest control expert Ed Rosenthal, author of the new book, Protect Your Garden, from Quick American Publishing. Ed, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mike.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I know you've been in this business as long as I have. So most of your book, I would say the big part of your book is devoted to a great A to Z look at pests all the way from aphids to whiteflies. Now, you garden in California, right? In Oakland, which is just across the bridge from San Francisco. Is that correct?
That's right.
In your area, in your part
yes.
of California, what kind of pests are your neighbors dealing with most? I know you did not limit yourself here. You're talking about cuke beetles. You're talking about Japanese beetles, which you guys are trying very hard to keep out of your environment.
Right.
What's the common problem you hear from your fellow gardeners?
Mites are a really big problem over a wide range of plants ranging from roses through eggplant. I mean, just everywhere. There are different kinds. We have a red and it's two-spotted mite and it's several others.
Now, it's interesting that you touch on mites because that's a pest that people really don't know much about. Everybody has heard of, quote, the spider mite. But I know that there are a lot of other destructive mites, and these creatures kind of pass under the radar most of the time because they're, as you say, they're not insects, they're arachnids, and they're, as their name implies, they're tiny.
Well, they're very tiny, and they live under the leaf, I mean, on the underside of the leaf rather than the top. So you're going to see the damage before you actually see the creature, and the damage is a little brown spot with a ring of yellow around it. And that the necrosis is where it plunges its proboscis, which acts like a straw to suck the juices out. And the thing about mites is that their reproductive cycle is so fast, like every 5 days they can start a new cycle. And they like large families. So you have this logarithmic progression from first infection, and it could, you know, just be one individual flying into your greenhouse, for instance, or getting onto your plant, and before you know it, you know, they're having a big party and building webs. And when they get to a certain critical mass, they start building these webs, and you'll see them going this way and that way across a web. And I'm wondering, why are they going in these different directions? Do they have appointments or
yeah.
they doing business, you know?
Now, yeah. Ed, I know that spider mites make distinctive webbing. That's how they got their name. Are there other mites that have a similar symptom, you could say, to give them up?
Yes, many of them do that. And there's a new mite that's really a plague often in houseplants, and that's called the russet mite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a tenth the size of a regular mite, which are tiny. I mean, they're, you know, a mite might
that
be
is like
64th
almost
of an inch.
Yeah.
It's microscopic, but they do the damage, and they're ferocious.
Now, describe the damage the russet mite does. What are we going to see on our plants?
It's the same thing. You'll see these necrotic spots, and then the leaves are going to start turning inward from them. And the whole plant will lose vigor as the mites take more and more sap out of the plant.
So you've really got to turn a leaf upside down and look at it with a magnifying glass?
Yeah, but that's pretty easy to do.
Well, I'm not saying I won't do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
What kind of controls do you like? Because the first thing I would do in this kind of situation is I would take the plant to some place where I could get wet, and I would try to do a knockdown with sharp streams of water. Yeah.
Exactly. That if you're able to do that, if the plant is small enough, you know, for you to be able to do it, or if you could take it outside or whatever, you'll take immediate stress off the plant if you knock out a good portion of the population with a sharp spray of water.
Now, you say there's a couple of natural products that you like for mite control. Which of those or your other choice would you use for, like, a follow-up after we wash off the majority?
Many of the spices and herbs that we use are protectants to the plant. For instance, cinnamon has cinnamaldehyde. And if you want to see something really crazy, take a teaspoon of cinnamon powder and put it on an anthill and see what happens. The ants go crazy trying to avoid it. They start carrying the eggs out of the holes and so on. It's so incredible. You rarely see insects on oregano or rosemary or thyme. right?
Right.
You notice that. And so the reason is that they produce those odors. So a lot of the pest control that is in this book is based on that fact.
And I know that that's something that really does appeal to our listeners. They're always looking under their kitchen counters or in their medicine chest for stuff. And I'm much more comfortable with them going into the garden and, as you say, harvesting some of their rosemary, making a tea from that, and using that natural insect repellency. This is the kind of book that we really need out there, a complete guide to identifying the insect pests in your garden, and then really strong explanations of the controls that are used against them, how to use them effectively, and you even include beneficial insects in those controls. Ed Rosenthal's Protect Your Garden is a brand new book. It shows you what's eating your plants, and then tells you how to stop them in a natural way. Ed, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, Bob. Where are you?
Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, in the middle of the country.
Always a pleasure to hear from our friends down there. We love our listeners in Oklahoma. What can we do for Bob in OKOK?
Well, I have a pear tree that's about 8 foot tall. I planted it a couple of years ago. And I've noticed in the last 2 weeks, a bunch of the leaves are turning upside down, which is kind of strange. And the only thing I've done in the last month is fertilize it with some Miracle-Gro.
Oh, why did you do that?
Oh, whoops. Well, I guess I didn't know any better.
Well, first of all, we're getting towards the end of the season. And
yeah.
One of the rules of any kind of fruit trees is, for God's sake, never feed them past July. It's actually safer to do all of your feeding in the spring, because after they've produced their fruits, when they're ripening their fruits up, they're using stored nutrition, they're thinking about going dormant for the winter, and then you hit them not only with fertilizer, but with chemical fertilizer, that they have no choice. If they're growing in rich soil, they can take what they want and leave the rest behind. But you're like injecting them with steroids when you do that Miracle-Gro, and that gave them a burst of unnatural energy that caused a late growth spurt that has probably confused the tree. Now, is it mulched?
No, it's not.
Okay, good, good. Have you fed it before this?
I fed it in spring some tree spikes.
Oh, those are terrible too, Bob. I call those the spikes of death. Now, do we have some nice-looking pears on the tree?
I did at the beginning, earlier in the summer until the birds decided to eat them all. But
oh, okay. So you know now next year you've got to invest in bird netting.
Okay.
The nice thing about pears is they don't need a lot of constant attention. The only thing you should be feeding this tree is some compost, a mulch of an inch or two of compost every spring. That'll give the tree all the nutrients it needs, and it'll be natural, slow-release nutrients. Now, you say after you use the chemical fertilizer, your leaves turned upside down, and while the fruit was there, it looked fine.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Okay. Have you noticed any yellowing of the leaves or any black schmutz on them?
No, I have not.
Okay. Because, you know, leaves that curl on a pear tree are typically the result of an attack by aphids. And aphids love going after plants that have been chemically fed. It attracts them. So one thing I want you to do is go out and really take a look at some of these turned around leaves and rub your hand over a couple of them and see if you get all messy. See if there's little tiny insects all over those leaves. And if there are, I want you to get a garden hose and early in the morning get up close and just spray really hard on those affected leaves. Blast the aphids off, because that's what it sounds like. Otherwise, don't do anything. If you're going to do any pruning, you do that in either the dead of winter or early spring. But I advise you to mulch it with compost, no more chemical fertilizer. And then once the fruits start forming, then I think it would be really smart to protect the tree. Bird netting is what you're going to have to use. What you want to do is pound some stakes or get some bamboo into the ground around the tree, put the netting over top of it, and then have a way you can pull it closed at the bottom. And that way your fruit will be protected without you being out there every day waving a broom around and yelling and screaming at creatures.
Thank you for straightening me out.
All right, Bob. I hope you get some pears next year, man.
Yeah, me too. Well, thanks a lot.
All right, good luck, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Phyllis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Phyllis. How are you?
Well, I am fine right now. I'm sitting looking at my beautiful plants.
Where is Phyllis?
In the northwest section of Philadelphia called Germantown.
Oh, okay. I know Germantown.
Mm-hmm.
Our musical director, Ken Queter, lives in Germantown. It's a beautiful old area of the city. All right, what can we do for Phyllis in Germantown?
Well, I have a large backyard that I pretty much keep just sown. But earlier this year, I got some amaryllis, and they had come up in Christmas. They looked spectacular, so I tried to keep them.
Right.
And I have two big pots in the back. I've given up trying to do flowers in the back because they get taken over by the weeds and the hosta.
Mm-hmm.
But in the pots, I can control them. So I planted the amaryllis when the weather turned warm, and it said, plant them outside for,
right, right,
for sun. I planted them there, and then I saw some caladium, and I planted those
right
around the edge of the pot.
Okay.
And so they've really come up spectacular. They're two great-looking plots, pots.
Good.
There's the amaryllis leaves in the center, and mm-hmm, then these big, beautiful caladium leaves.
Right, which are elephant's ears, right?
Yes, actually, that's what they call them.
Yes.
I want to keep it next year. I'm so pleased.
Yeah, that's fine.
I've not had anything do this well.
Okay.
So I want to be sure I do it.
We're talking two very different types of plants. Your amaryllis needs a period of rest to rebloom. And it's up to you whether you want to give it a short rest and try to get it to rebloom indoors after the holidays, or you could let it rest for 6 months and put it outside next late spring and perhaps get it to bloom outdoors in the summer, although most people want these as indoor plants. The caladium are much easier. These are summer blooming bulbs, and they're not cold hardy. So they must be, quote, lifted. Now, because you're in the city, if your caladiums were in the ground, like right next to your house, I would say you'd have a good chance of keeping them alive if you just cut them back to the ground after the first frost and covered them with well-shredded leaves. But since they're in pots, they're already above the soil line, I think we need to bring them inside. Before too much longer, I want you to dig out the amaryllis bulbs and bring those inside. Just put them in a cardboard box in a cool, dry spot in your house.
Even though they've still got all these leaves.
Yes, because those leaves have absorbed a lot of solar energy over the summer. They've already done everything they can to help form a new flower for the next blooming cycle inside.
Okay.
So I don't want you to cut off the leaves. Just, you know, but they're not getting much solar energy now anyway. We're moving way past the time of photosynthesis and getting into chilly nights that this really tropical plant doesn't like. Leaving the leaves in place will give them a natural source of moisture. And then they'll go dormant. After they've been dormant for 2 or 3 months, you can take them out of storage and pot them up. And you know how to pot up amaryllis with at least half the bulb above the soil line?
Yes, that's what I did before. But you're saying leave the leaves on?
Leave the leaves on over the winter while they're in storage. And then when you're ready to try reblooming it, those leaves will have turned brown and brittle, and you can just get them off easily without disturbing the flower head. Then you can either force it to grow inside, which is where most people want to see those flowers, or you can wait till all chance of frost is gone, and you can plant it outside. You may get your amaryllis flowers out there, which would be very unusual and very cool. With the caladiums, with the elephant ears, they're not as frost tender, but I worry about them because they're in pots. So once we start getting, the nights start getting into the 30s reliably, then you need to pull those. You need to actually lift those out of the pot. And in most cases, in with plants like this, we do cut the leaves off and we just store the bulb or the rhizome. And then cut the leaves off the caladiums. And then they should probably be stored in a box full of peat moss or something like that. And then you'll just repot them again, after all chance of frost in the springtime.
Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Phyllis.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind those of you listening to us on broadcast radio that shows like You Bet Your Garden wouldn't be on the air without the support of public radio members, and that it's fall pledge drive time at a lot of public radio stations this month around the country. So if you're just a listener, please consider becoming a member of your local public radio station. And if you already are a member, thank you for your support. But don't be checking your membership status just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a tale of two different kinds of coxcomb. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden host Mike McGrath will lead a small group of adventurous plant lovers on a culturally rich tour of the gardens of Cuba this coming January. Details at earthboundexpeditions.com. Earthbound Expedition supports You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that summer is the time to obtain garlic and spring bulbs for planting in the fall, as well as seeds for fall crops of pansies, salad green seeds, and other cool weather lovers. Learn more at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. A listener in a faraway land wants to grow, quote, the tall variety of coxcomb. We'll confound the issue further as we help him on his path to tall, beautiful flowers. Right after we take a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you today?
I am doing very well, Peter. How about yourself?
Well, it is a gorgeous fall day here in wonderful New Brunswick. I've been trying to grow broccoli this year, and I haven't had much success with it. I planted the seedlings and had them in a little heating box and planted them out in about mid-June. And then all that happened was that they shot up and flowered and didn't do nothing in the way of producing edible broccoli plants. What did I do wrong?
Well, one of the things you did wrong was you didn't try eating your failures. Now, where you are in New Brunswick, you said that's a very challenging climate. What are you, zone 3 or 4 or something?
Free. We are free here in western New Brunswick, Woodstock. We can have very nice weather, but we can have also very nasty weather.
Right. Well, the zone information simply refers to how cold your winters get. And being in zone 3...
maximum.
Exactly. Yeah. You have the coldest possible winters of anybody, like in North America. But you can have very pleasant summers. It would seem
That's
that true. Your weather is ideal for growing cold crops like broccoli and cabbages. New Brunswick is known for its cabbages. This was your first year.
This was my first year trying this, and it is also challenged. It is only a small raised bed, about 18 by 3, and it is also partly shaded from a maple tree during the day, which I won't get rid of. I love that tree.
Oh no, that's fun.
It's not going to go.
Okay.
You know.
Have you been growing other things successfully over the years?
Well, I did grow radishes and also salad greens, and I did have some success with tomatoes. But I didn't really also seriously try. I just, you know, did that on the side. I'm trucking through the week, and I am home on a regular basis, but I'm not watching it day by day. So
I'm surprised that your summers got warm enough for tomatoes. Did you have them under cover in a little mini greenhouse or something?
That I did grow the seedlings until, you know, let's say mid-end of June, and then I put them out in the garden, and then it stays warm enough, and we don't have any frost anymore. So it is all right that way. And I know that there are many of my neighbors are growing tomatoes successfully.
Okay, that's great. That's great. You started your broccoli seed indoors.
Correct.
Okay. And the broccoli plants looked okay when you put them in the ground.
They looked okay, and they grew on, and I was doing just fine until I put them in the bed, and then they just shot up and flowered, and that was it.
How warm was your June and July?
Well, we had average temperatures, or we still had the occasional night frost by the end of May or beginning of June. But then it warmed up pretty nicely, and it was in the, you know, mid-70s already in June, and occasionally by the end of June we had already reached some 80s.
Okay, so the two things could have happened. One, depending on what kind of seed you started with, you could have actually been growing what's called Italian sprouting broccoli, which is either the same thing as broccoli rabe or similar to broccoli rabe. And this is not the type of plant that forms a really tight head, but the kind of plant that sends up a lot of shoots that are quick to flower. But it's a hugely popular ingredient, especially in Italian dishes. Here in Philly, you can't get an Italian meat sandwich down in South Philly without somebody offering to put greens on it, and that's generally broccoli rabe or sprouting broccoli.
Uh-huh.
The other possibility is that you simply put it out too late and that it bolted right away, that all of a sudden the temperature got too hot. The heads of broccoli develop best in really cool weather. And, you know, those plants can take a frost. They're not bothered by frost whatsoever. So if you want to do this again, I might start the plants earlier. And then once they get to be about 6 weeks of age, I would put them out. Even if it was still really cold, even if you were still getting some light frosts and some snow, and that's the really big chance. But broccoli is also a full sun plant. So if your raised bed is partially shaded, that sounds great for salad greens and other things. but I would make a container to try to grow the regular broccoli in. Although it sounds like you could also just cut to the chase and deliberately buy seeds of sprouting broccoli, broccoli rabe, and enjoy that. It's easier to handle when you're not around because you really have to be there to harvest that big head at the right time. Whereby sprouting broccoli, you just cut it all season long, stir fry it up with some garlic. It's absolutely sensational.
Fabulous. Mike, thank you very much. I might have just bought the wrong thing and didn't even notice it or wasn't aware of it. And that might have been part of the problem here. I will try at least one more time. Thank you.
Gardening is the art of constant improvement, Peter.
That is true.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you very much. Nice to be on your show. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
I'm doing good, Tom. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very good. Having some trouble with weeds in my yard.
And where is Tom's yard?
Down in Towne, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. What can we do for this yard in Downingtown?
So we bought the house about 6 years ago, and it's an acre and a half. We always had a dandelion problem at the bottom of the hill on our yard. It's fairly flat, but it slopes down. We kind of always kind of let that go. We've been watching as the last couple of years have been creeping up a new weed that's kind of been just taking over the yard. And at first it started down low, and we just kind of left it alone. And we have kids, so we're concerned about putting stuff on the yard. And it's just really getting out of control. I mow my own yard. I discharge the grass. But I'm just really having a tough time getting our arms around it. We hired a company a while back, maybe 2 years ago. We did an aeration and overseed pretty late fall. It really didn't seem to make a difference. And we, you know, just kind of let it go. So we had a company come out here. Well, I say we, but I had a company come out here and spray for weeds. And it really hasn't seemed to impact the weeds at all either.
Has the weed been identified?
It has not been identified. We had the guy out here today just to kind of take a look at the results of the application that they put on, and there were some other concerns. But he seemed to think it was some sort of spurge, which I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
The only thing I could find online was maybe like a prostrate knotweed.
Knotweed. There's a million things that it could
it grows
be.
Really thick. And, you know, he seemed to have a suggestion as far as, look, you need to keep aerating and overseeding, and that's part of the long-term solution.
Okay,
and
he's right.
And it might take you 3 years to do that.
Okay, he's right. Now, you cut the lawn, right?
I cut the lawn, yep.
And how high is the lawn when you're done cutting it?
I leave it at 3.5 inches throughout the summer.
Okay, you're sure?
A little higher. Am I sure? No. It's set to 3.5 inches from the deck height on the mower, so I've never actually measured it with a ruler.
Okay. Well, you know, your neighbors think you're crazy already, so it's time to get out there with the ruler and actually see if there's any correlation there. Sometimes the height of the soil when the lawn was laid makes that a kind of a bogus notch on the side of the machine. Now, you are returning your clippings to the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And you say you have an acre and a half of lawn.
Right.
What about the lawn right around your house? How does that look?
It's okay, but the weed has encroached in that. And I can only imagine maybe some of the seeds of these weeds are getting on my blower deck or something for the lawnmower.
So
and
here's
it's
what,
just spreading around.
One thing I would suggest to you, if there is a kind of a Maginot line here, where this weed is mostly on the other side of,
right,
I would urge you to drive in some edging and
make
a distinct area
on
our side of the barrier, the good lawn side, if there's an area where this weed is just beginning to take hold. It's a little bit late in the season. It sounds like you worked late in the season last year, but right now it's all we got. I would actually till up in front of that area and really loosen up the soil, rake away as much of the green material, both grass and weed, as I could, have a nice load of compost delivered to fill that in, make it level again, and sow matching seed. This time of year, there's still a good month for that root system to get established. In the spring, I would use corn gluten meal, try to find the timing for the germination of any seeds for this thing, and spread corn gluten meal about 2 weeks before that. Do you typically feed your lawn?
No.
Never?
No. I mean, I'm probably your typical homeowner.
Okay, I have
a yard. I mow my yard.
Okay.
And, you know,
well, no, that means there's things you can improve on. Being organic doesn't mean doing nothing.
Right.
The way you control a lawn weed is to build up the lawn. That means feeding in the spring, feeding in the fall, never feeding in the summer, always cutting at 3 inches high. Make sure your mower has a very sharp blade. And then, yes, core aeration and a little bit of overseeding in the fall after that feeding is marvelous. But you do that. You get on a regular schedule of treating your lawn like a living plant that needs the correct nutrition at the right time. And I bet you it'll just beat the weed.
Okay.
All right, Tom?
That's great. I appreciate your help.
All right. Good luck, sir.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. There's more than one way to grow a coxcomb. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, would you kindly read this week's question?
Sure. That won't take long. It just says, hi, can you tell me where I can buy the tall growing variety of coxcomb? Thank you, signed Colin. Now, I know you always email people back and ask their location. So where is Colin? Philadelphia? Dayton? Oklahoma?
Colin is in England.
No way.
Way. Specifically, St. Albans in Hertfordshire, which is up near Leeds, and which means that Colin has to find his own plants. I checked with Don Zeidler from the W. Attlee Burpee Seed Company here in the States, and he doesn't know of any American suppliers that'll ship overseas. The regulations are just too strict and the expense is too prohibitive. But the UK has many fine seed suppliers of their own. And once we help Colin better understand exactly what he's looking for, he should be able to achieve his goal, especially if he has the ability to grow plants from seed.
You don't think he can find what he wants already started at a garden center? After all, we're talking about a really popular summertime bedding plant. Coxcombs are the ones with beautiful colored spikes of red or orange flowers at the top, right?
Yes, but my experience is that garden center plants mostly tend to be compact varieties, bred to stay about a foot or so tall so that they'll fit in well with the other bedding plants. But seed catalogs carry varieties that can reach almost 3 feet. So if he's willing to start with seeds, he can probably grow taller plants than a garden center is going to carry. But first, he has to figure out which kind of coxcomb he actually wants.
Oh, there's more than one kind?
Yes, coxcomb is actually the common name for a species of celosia. And really, it's the only species in a pretty big genus that's grown commercially. But that single species has two radically different forms. We American gardeners are mostly used to seeing what's known as the plumosa group, with tall, erect plumes of brightly colored flowers.
Right. Coxcombs.
Not really. Although the plumosa types are what we've come to expect when we hear the word coxcomb, true coxcombs are members of what's called the cristata, or crested group, and they have a completely different flower head shape. It's kind of wavy, looks a little bit like a flattened out section of brain. And apparently, somebody influential once decided it resembled the comb on a rooster's head.
Sounds wild.
It is very unusual. We'll post photos of both types at our website. Maybe we'll throw a rooster's head in there for comparison.
So do you think that his local nursery in England will only have the plume-headed types?
Well, Colin only said, quote, coxcomb, and because that term has become so generic for celosia, we really don't know which kind of plant caught his eye. He might want big plumes instead of squishy brains. Luckily, in a garden center, the plants will be blooming, so he'll see which kind they are. But I still think he's going to need to grow his own if he wants really tall ones.
And you always warn that seed starting is much harder than actual outdoor growing.
Absolutely. But there is such a high concentration of extremely enthusiastic gardeners in England that there's likely somebody nearby with the right skills, and probably even a greenhouse of some kind. The summers in England are cooler than ours, and in most regions you need a greenhouse or some other kind of structure to grow things like peppers and tomatoes, or as they might say over there, tomatoes.
Now, is celosia hard to start from seed?
I did some research, and it does look to be a little tougher than average. The seeds need to be exposed to light, which is always tricky, and the germination time is listed at 14 to 21 days, which is 2 to 3 times longer than things like marigolds and tomatoes.
You mean tomatoes?
Yeah, right. Listen, Your Highness, the question may have come from the UK, but we're still coming from Philadelphia. Anyway, I want to suggest a nice alternative that should be much easier to grow. Ornamental amaranth.
Oh, like that beautiful heirloom elephant's head amaranth you grow. It's very tall. And you're right, it has a huge and colorful seed head.
And that's just one variety. There's a lot of other tall ornamental amaranths that have huge seed heads. And in the same color range as coxcomb, which isn't surprising as celosia is actually a member of what's called the amaranthus family. So if our listener can't get the height he wants in a coxcomb, he should try an ornamental amaranth. They're easier to grow and just as big a showstopper in the garden. Well, that sure was a celebratory look at celosia now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to annihilate my amaranth if I don't get out of this studio. Come on, you didn't really think I'd try anything with coxcomb, did you? Anyway, we must be out of time, but you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired report, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Lunas, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our expert ornamental enablers include editor Al Banks, production assistant Effie Kong, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, elephant-headed Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. That chill in the air means it's prime time for chores. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal 10 tips that'll help you have an awesomely agricultural autumn, indoors and out, plus your fabulous phone calls.